Tonight's guest is Lee Nelson. He is quite a figure in Utah. He's had a real writing career. He's written 30 books or more.
I quit counting.
Quit counting, okay. Can't count past 30? Anyway, 30, that's a lot of books to publish. He's actually made a living at it for some 20-plus years, which is remarkable in the writing industry. And he works with Cedar Fort Publishing. They work out of Springville. Lee has published this four-volume series called Beyond the Veil, but they are available on Cedar Fort, probably cedarfort.com. A collection of a lot of other people's experiences. So Lee's going to share some of that with us. He's well known as a great storyteller. He's written also historical books, Utah, and I'm forgetting the title of the
Storm Testament.
Storm Testament, for those of you who are readers, you might be familiar with that.
10 of those.
And apparently he really gets into his subject. If he rides bareback and goes after a buffalo with a bow and arrow so he can write about it, that's pretty cool. Now, I don't know if he had a near-death experience so that he could talk about it, but who knows? I'll let him explain that to you. Let's give a warm welcome to Lee Nelson.
He mentioned Cedar Fort. They published these four volumes about 20 years ago, and they sold a lot of copies, I mean, like 500,000. What we're looking for now, more detailed stories, where we can make one story into a whole book. If you know something that's good enough or has enough detail to fill 100 pages or more, we would really love to talk to you on that. And you've got my email address, you can query me. But these books continue to sell, and I think I know why. And I'll touch on some of those concepts tonight. You mentioned to Doug, this isn't a normal audience. This is probably what I would call a knowledgeable, sophisticated audience as far as near-death experiences go, so I don't need to get into so many of the fundamentals. Is the more interesting, the unusual things I've found in my research. I went to a school at Cal Berkeley, and I remember taking a philosophy class, and I was 19 years old, and this young professor, he's probably about 30 years old, and I just remember he had the worst color combinations I've ever seen anybody dress that way. I mean, orange and green and browns and funny looking ties and a strange fellow. But he was an avid atheist, and he made that very clear right in the beginning. And a few times in class I remember him saying, if there's a life after death, why hasn't anybody ever come back to tell about it? You know, I'd sit there and think, oh, I hope he doesn't call on me. I'd say, I don't know. And over the years, as I got into research in near-death experiences, I just thought, oh, I wish I could go back to that class. And I'd raise my hand when he said that. And what I would tell him is, maybe I'd insult him, saying he wasn't very well read. And then I would say, the truth is, millions of people have come back to tell about it. Gallup did a poll about 20 years ago when Raymond Moody's book was an international bestseller. And they concluded that approximately 6 million Americans have had some kind of near-death experience. And so the professor was really out in left field. He had no idea what he was saying. And I think a lot of that goes back to the 50s and 60s. We're making nuclear bombs and trying to put men on the moon, and it was this scientific age, and we just didn't talk about this kind of stuff. When Raymond Moody's book became the bestseller, I don't think he had any clue when he wrote it what he was doing, what he was starting, what he was opening up. He even, if you read the foreword, he mentions changing everybody's name in the book because so people wouldn't be embarrassed, so they wouldn't be ridiculed by neighbors and friends. That's how people felt back then. And I don't remember anybody in these books saying, oh, don't put my name in it. I remember one lady I interviewed, and she had died in childbirth and come back, and she got well, and some of the Relief Society sisters would come in and talk to her, and she'd tell them how she went through the tunnel and saw the light, and you know, the typical near-death experience, and And her husband found out that she was telling people this. And he was, they were both active in the LDS church. And she said, he forbid me to tell anybody else in our ward to even, not to even talk about it. He was embarrassed. And he didn't want the people in the church thinking he was married to a crazy lady. So she tells me this. I say, well, why are you telling me? If you're forbidden, she says, oh, I divorced him a long time ago. Now I can tell anybody I want. I kind of got interested in this field through the back door. I remember seeing Moody's book on the bestseller list, but I was busy writing my storm testaments and out. I didn't chase the buffalo bareback. When the Plains Indians started chasing buffalo with bow and arrows, they started using crude saddles. And it wasn't because they were afraid of falling off their horses. But if you have a bow and arrow and you're on a galloping horse, if you're sitting on the back, flat bareback like an Indian rides, it's really hard to hit anything. But if you have stirrups and can kind of put your weight in the stirrups so your knees can absorb the jar of the galloping horse, you're 10 times more accurate with your arrows. And they learned that immediately. So it's not bareback. But I did do it. But it was a few years ago. Anyway, that's what I was involved in. My historical novels were doing well. One day, Lyle Mortimer, who started Cedar Fort, he ran into me somewhere. He called me and asked me to come into his office. And he says, have you heard about Raymond Moody's book? And I says, yeah. And he says, I would really love to publish something like that with kind of a local, somewhat LDS theme to it that we could sell in this market through the desert bookstores. And I says, why are you telling me this? I says, I write fiction. And he says, I've lined up two people to write this book for me. And it just never gets done. I've been pushing them for 2 years and nothing. And he says, so I called you because I know you make a living at writing. It's not a hobby. They say if you want something done, you call the busiest person you know to do it. And he says, I just thought if you agreed to do it, even though you write fiction, that I'd probably see a book in 2 or 3 months. And I said, well, yeah, I use some more money all the time. I had eight children. Those of you that big families, you know how the money can go with that many children. And so I said, well, would you pay in advance? And he said, yes, we would. And then I said, well, I just have one more question. Where do I find the stories? I don't know anybody who's had a near-death experience, and I was being quite honest. And he says, you're the author, that's your job. And so I thought, well, this may not work out after all. And that afternoon, it was a huge eye-opening. I went to a soccer game at Springville High School. My second son was on the school soccer team, and they were having a game, and I really didn't enjoy going to soccer games. where they played for 2 hours and might score 1 point. And so this game, I just kind of wandered around the sidelines and I'd see some of my friends, parents of my classmates, and I just started telling people, people I knew, not strangers. And I said, yeah, they want me to write this book about near-death experiences, and they want me to interview people and write up their stories, and I don't know anybody. I mean, tell me how to do that. And I wasn't really working at it, but just during the course of the game, I probably talked to 7 or 8 people. By the time I drove home, I had 4 slips of paper, a gum wrapper, and a bank deposit slip, and just whatever I could find in my pocket and wallet. And they all had names and phone numbers on them. And like one lady said, well, call my sister up in Seattle, her next door neighbor. Died in this terrible accident, and she was declared dead, and I'm sure she talked to you. And somebody else, oh, call my this friend of mine up in Lehigh. He has a friend who died in an industrial accident, was electrocuted while standing in 6 inches of water. Really an amazing story. And I had 4 phone numbers and good leads by the end of the soccer game. So what does that tell you? The Gallup was right. And this was just in Springville. And I think one of my books, I've probably done 4 or 5 stories from Mapleton, where I live. And probably none of you live in towns that small. I mean, there's no stoplights and there's no grocery stores. There's a gas station, well, 2 gas stations actually, and that's about it. And yet, I found a number of good stories right in my own hometown, a number of them in Springville. And so I went down the next day and said, okay, give me the van. I'll do it. And then the adventure began. The typical story that you're all familiar with, somebody dies. Maybe they're sick. Maybe they're in the hospital. Maybe they've been in a terrible accident of some kind, a heart attack, anything. Most of them, or a lot of them, remember rising, their spirit rising out of their body. And at first they're kind of surprised and maybe a little, well, this is crazy. And I'll read you one in a minute where a lady just couldn't get over the fact that her mouth was open in her body. You need to close that. That's a terrible way to work when I did. And then if they're in a hospital, a lot of them remember actually going through the ceiling or through a wall as they leave. Many of them find themselves in the tunnel and they see that bright, warm light at the far end and they go through the tunnel. And then there's one puzzle. Maybe somebody here can straighten me out. I've never been able to figure it out. Some of the people go into a really nice reception area with chandeliers and nice carpets and beautiful drapes, and it's an inside setting where these warm, nice, happy people are welcoming, the angels, I guess is the word to describe them. And then the other part, there are other people end up in a beautiful outdoor setting with trees and lawn and flowers and a beautiful stream, and they describe this, usually not a wilderness setting, but more of a real beautiful park-like setting, really lush and green. And I thought I had it figured out once, and I thought, oh, the people that die in the winter go to the room, and the people that die in the summer go to the park. And I couldn't get enough evidence to really nail that down, so I don't know if that has anything to do with it. And one of the best stories I found initially was actually a neighbor of mine. He lived in Mapleton. His name was Carlos Short. He since passed away. When they were building the Strawberry Tunnel up at the head of Diamond Fork Canyon, they had to drill this tunnel through the mountain to Strawberry Reservoir, and then they would dam up the reservoir. The water that was supposed to go to California, and they would push it back through this tunnel to come down Diamond Fork into Utah County to water all the farms there with California water. He was helped building the pipes, the fabrication, and one of the specifications required that each time they built an elbow, they had this big, huge steel ball they had to pull through it to make sure they had the necessary width to handle the water that the system was going to carry. And they were out in the shop right there where the old Hart's gas station was in Mapleton. I think they call it the Junction now. And he was out back in that steel building, and they were pulling this big ball through this elbow of pipe, and it got stuck. And they could see the motor kind of straining, and they could see the pulleys shaking and vibrating, and they knew how much power was in that motor and also that pulley system, and the ball was not coming through. And so somebody just told him, let's get out of here. You know, we can't fix it. Something's going to be given. Just as he went out the door, the pulley broke and the cable broke. And the pulley hit him in the back and it broke about 4 or 5 ribs. It damaged his spleen and his liver. Very young. Very, of course, serious injury. And he was down on the cement, and he describes his brother and a friend named, I think, Freeman Bird, came, and they gave him a priesthood blessing, which would be the natural thing to do in the LDS culture. And they promised him that he wouldn't die. And the ambulance arrives and takes him to Utah Valley Hospital. On the way, he died. And he describes going through the tunnel, the typical thing, the warm light, and going in the room with all these nice people. He said they were wearing white robes. and they were welcoming him. He stopped them and he says, first of all, I was blessed that I wouldn't die. Well, you're supposed to honor that. And then he says, I have four little boys under the age of eight. And I've got to raise them. You can't take me away from them. And Nathan says, no, your body's damaged too much. You have to stay here. You can't go back. And he said he started yelling at the angels. I'm not sure. I don't think he swore at him. He wouldn't admit that when I interviewed him. But he said he was yelling and he was angry. You have to send me back. And then he said, he kind of calmed down a little and he started begging. He says, all I want is 20 years, just enough time to raise my little boys, and then you can come and get me and do with me what you want. And that was his attitude. And he was contentious and argumentative, and he refused to go with the program. The pain will be too great. You won't be able to live through it. And he says, oh, I know about pain. Give me a chance. And so finally, he's back in the hospital. And he was there quite a while. The reason he had so much detail is he wrote all this down. And he wrote it in his personal journal. And when I was interviewing him, 21 years later, he said, I was really surprised. He showed me the journal where he had written all this down. And he said, you're the first person besides me to read this. I says, why? This is really neat stuff. Why wouldn't you share it with your family? And he said, I begged and begged for 20 years. And so I thought I'd die at the end of the 20 years. And he says, I didn't want everybody to know I was dying last year. And he says, I was ready. And guess what? I said, you didn't die. And he says, right. I didn't. And he just didn't know that. But just a neat story. I get into some, and you know the typical stories. You've all read lots of them. The one thing I didn't mention in the beginning, coming to groups like this, a lot of times when I'm asked to give a talk, a day or two before, why did I agree to do? No. There's so much going on, and I mean, tonight, we're missing a Jazz game against Chicago and a BYU game, a Shimmer for Debt, and sometimes you just have those hesitations, but I didn't feel that way this week. I just was kind of glad I got to come and talk about this again, but until I came in the room, I was sitting back there looking through one of my books, and this nice lady comes in, and the first thing she says, oh, you're the speaker. Have you had a near-death experience? I said, no. And it was like, I'm not failed. Like we used to say in business school, if you can't do it, teach it. But what I confess to you is when these books started doing well and I kept getting more and more interested in it, I thought I could do a better job if I had my own near-death experience. And I started including that in my prayers. I'd say stuff like, God, these books are making a difference in some people's lives, and they just keep selling year after year, and I think I could do a better job if, and maybe I would learn some things that aren't in the typical experience that would be helpful, and maybe you ought to help me do this. Just don't hurt it to hurt me too much. And, I don't know why that prayer was never answered. I really don't. But anyway, let me just touch on some quite unusual stories. These are in my volume 3, and I shouldn't be two stories out of the same book because I only brought 4 of these, and they'll go probably pretty fast. This is a story that's been floating around the Utah culture for decades, and I've heard different versions of it verbally, and I finally found a copy of the original. It's not really a near-death experience, but more of a resurrection experience, but it's probably one of the most famous stories in Utah's history that I know of. And it's by a man named Zeke Johnson. Let me just read it to you. I love reading stories and I love listening to stories. I have been asked to relate an experience I had in 1908 or 1909 in San Juan County, Utah. That's down by Blanding. I was just making a home in Blanding, and the whole country there was covered with trees and sagebrush. I was working to clear the ground to plant a few acres of corn. We had 5 acres cleared, and it started to plant the corn. I would plow open a furrow, then my boy would drop in the seeds. Last, I would cover the furrow by running the plow along the side of the row. We can assume here he was probably driving a horse or a mule to do this. It doesn't sound like a tractor. In 1909, that would make sense. While I was plowing on that piece of ground, I discovered ancient houses, or the remains of them. As I was moving along, I noticed that my plow had turned over the skeleton of a small child. The skull and backbone were present, but most of the other bones were decayed and gone. Immediately I stopped, though the plow had already passed the skeleton. I stepped aside and looked down over the crossbar and between the plow handles. As I was looking at the little skeleton, wondering what to do about it, I noticed that the bones were beginning to wiggle and change positions, at the same time taking on a different color. A minute later, I was looking at a complete little skeleton. It was perfect. Then, to my amazement, I saw the inner parts of the natural body enter the skeleton, the entrails, organs, etc. I saw the flesh coming on, and I saw skin cover the body after the inner parts were complete. A beautiful head of hair adorned the top of the head. The child was on its side with its back to me, so I wasn't able to discern its sex. But as it raised to its feet, a beautiful robe came down over its left shoulder, and I saw it was a girl, maybe 5 to 7 years old. She looked up at me, and I looked at her for perhaps a quarter of a minute. We just stared at each other, both of us smiling. "Oh, you beautiful child," I said, reaching out to embrace her. Before I could touch her, she disappeared. That was all I saw, and I stood there wondering what it meant. Several minutes passed. My little boy was down at the end of the row wondering why I had stopped. What I had seen was so mysterious that I decided not to tell anyone about it. I couldn't figure out why such a miraculous experience should happen to me. I couldn't tell the story to anyone until finally one day I met a dear friend of mine, a state patriarch named Wayne Redd in Blanding. He stopped me on the street and said, "Zeke, you have had an experience on this mesa you won't tell. I want you to tell it to me." I told him the entire story. From that time on, he would often ask me to tell it in church meetings and at socials and in conferences. I wondered a lot about what had happened. It worried me for years. I wanted to know why a simple man like me, common and uneducated, was allowed to see such a marvelous manifestation of God's power. I prayed incessantly for an answer as to why I was privileged to see that resurrection. One day, as I was walking down to a field to hoe some corn with my hoe over my shoulder, something told me to stop under the shade of a certain tree and rest. The feeling was so strong that I decided to do it. As I sat down, my prayers were answered. I was allowed to know why I had seen that resurrection. When the child was buried there, it was either a time of war with a different tribe, and there was no time for a proper burial, or it was winter, with the ground so frozen too hard to dig a proper grave. They buried the little girl as deep as they could, considering the circumstances. When it was done, the sorrowing mother knew that with the grave so shallow, the first beast to come along would smell the body and dig up the child and scatter the bones all over the flats. There was a man present who told the mother to calm her sorrow. I believe he was a Nephite or a Jaredite with priesthood, because to comfort the mother, he blessed the grave that if the little body was ever uncovered or disturbed, the Lord would call it up immediately. Since that time, I have found great comfort, cheer, consolation, and satisfaction in what happened. Sometimes I have such strong feelings in my heart and soul that I can't find words to express how grateful I am. I was the one blessed to uncover that little girl and witness her glorious resurrection. Not really a near-death experience, but really a neat story that just will be in our culture forever. When a lot of times when manuscripts come in, especially if they're on anything medical or self-help, we always say, what's the credibility of the writer? What experience do they have? What degrees do they have? What qualifies them to tell everybody else how to live their lives? And when we find an incident that comes from somebody who's well-known, who has a lot of credibility, then that takes on a special interest. Juanita Brooks, she wrote the first objective book on Mount Meadows Massacre. Her son lives just down from you, Mapleton. She was a school teacher for many years, but did a lot of serious historical writing. What I have here is a letter she wrote to a good friend of hers, a sister, Espelin, who had just lost a son, about 20 years old, a young man that died, and that was really, a sad, sad, sad thing. When in about the middle of her letter, she said, that's where I'll start reading. I am tempted to tell you an experience of my own, which has changed my whole attitude towards our passing from this life. I have told it before, especially immediately after it happened, and even wrote it then so that I would not forget it. It happened when I first came here to teach. I was not well, and I gave myself so completely to my work that I was completely exhausted every night. I didn't know. School teachers, are you tired at night?
Yeah.
I never taught school. It seemed like, as I remember, my teachers didn't seem like we did anything to make them very tired. But I'm sure I'm totally off base on that. One evening, I climbed the hill to my home. This is in St. George. And was so tired that I went right to my bedroom and lay on the bed on my back. Soon I had the sensation of being away from myself, without any pain, whatever. I was just separate from my body. This is what I mentioned. I could see it, her body, and wish that my mouth were closed. But I just kept thinking, how strange. So this is what it's like to be dead. I remember how I wondered at it and how surprised it made me. Francis, that's her husband, will soon be here and find me. And he will call the folks, I thought. And so my mind ran on. She thought she'd died. Then suddenly, without the lapse of any time, I was at my father's home in Bunkerville. That's down by Mesquite. I thought how sad it was that two people who had had so many children should be there alone now. They were in the living room. There was a fire in the fireplace, and Mother was stirring in some mush in a saucepan over the coals. The house was so large and cold that they had not come into the kitchen to make a fire, and Daddy liked mush for his supper. He was shaking some cream in a 2-quart jar. Why? To make butter. Because their one cow did not give enough milk to use the big churn. And he was telling Mother how one of the horses had got another into the manger and was kicking it. The old fool would have killed him if I had not gone out, he said. I remember little things like the fact that the lamp wick was not even, and the flame was blackening the chimney a little on one side. And some ashes from the big log fell into the mush. And when Mother tried to get them out, Daddy said, "What won't fatten will fill." You could tell this was a long time ago. I am telling you all this to make you see how very real it was to me. And then in another flash, I was back in my bedroom in St. George, and on the bed, and able to move. But through it all, I was filled with wonder and kept saying, "So this is what it's like to be dead. I didn't think it would be like this." And when I was looking at my parents in Bunkerville, I thought, soon they will get the word that I am dead. I even wondered if the funeral would be in St. George or Bunkerville. Well, Francis came just after I had come to and turned over. I told him all about it right then. That was Friday night. And on Sunday, we went home to visit. And I told my folks, and every word of their conversation was real, even to the slang word Mother used when the cinders, maybe it was her father, fell into the mush. The churning, the horse in the manger, the smoking lamp, everything. Dear friends, and then she goes on and finishes her letter. Interesting stuff. I think over the years, as I look at books like these and how they sell, especially mine, where I can, you know, talk to the publisher and kind of see where the books are going, I find that a high percentage, I don't know exactly what it is, but people buy these kind of stories to give to loved ones who've lost somebody. And there's just a comfort there. Yeah, we all believe there's a life after death, but reading stories like this, it just kind of sets you at ease that, you know, it really isn't going to be that bad. I'm not afraid to die. Probably one of my favorite stories, which is quite unusual. I've always looked for stories where I'm taking a special interest when they're ones, well, yeah, my professor at Cal, how would he explain this one? I found such a story. In fact, I'm not sure how I found it. I can't remember now. But it was in a nursing journal over at BYU. And I either discovered it in an index or somebody told me about it. I can't remember. But it was an event that happened over in the foothills of the Swiss Alps. And it's in the spring, an April setting, green grass and white snow on the mountains and blue sky, a beautiful weekend day, a Friday or Saturday. And this man is driving, I'm not sure why he was alone, but he was driving to a really big soccer match. Somehow he got in a collision with another car. It was pretty severe. There were cars blocking the road. One of them turned upside down. He got thrown out of the car and he was laying in the grass. And he describes going up 5 feet, 10 feet, 20 feet, I think he got as far as 30 feet, and he kind of stopped. He could see his body down there, and some ambulance found a way through the traffic. He could see the paramedics putting it, after checking his vitals, they put a blanket over his body. I just died. This is what it's like. How interesting. You know, he was really curious. And then something happened that really made him sad. He could hear the people in the cars where the traffic was blocked. And some of them were swearing. And some of them were very angry. Why? They didn't want to be late to the soccer game. And, you know, he just died. His life was snuffed out. And all these people care about is the stupid soccer match. Suddenly, that wasn't important to him. He wasn't like, oh, I won't know who wins today. No, that wasn't. Didn't even enter his mind. And it made him angry. He said, what's wrong with these people? I'm laying dead there on the ground and they're worried about their soccer game. And then he hears another voice. And it's a woman. I guess he didn't care about soccer. And it was a prayer. And one thing you learn in these near-death experiences, and a lot of people notice it when they go to the other side, and some of them really don't notice it. But language isn't important, whether it's Spanish or Russian. Or I had a boy arrived in Taiwan today on his mission, and he's learning Mandarin Chinese. And languages aren't important. You just look at somebody, and we start communicating. We don't have to open our mouths and make grammatical errors. We can just communicate. So anyway, he hears a prayer. This lady is basically, she's praying to God, she's not talking to him, and she's saying something to the effect, well, God, it's such a beautiful day, and I don't know who this man is, I don't know what his religion is, but I know you can save him if you want to, and don't let him die on such a beautiful day in these circumstances. It's just, you know, him there covered with a blanket, and this is so, so, so sad. Please, God, don't let him die. And he was so touched by this prayer that he thought, well, I wonder if I can do anything to help the prayer be answered. And so I went back to 20 feet, and 15 feet, and 10 feet, and he was able to will himself under the blanket back into his body, and somehow managed to wiggle a finger or a toe, and the paramedics saw it, and immediately they were applying fluids and doing whatever they do, and they rushed him into the ambulance and somehow got him to the hospital, and he survived. And it was like Carlos Shore, pretty serious injuries, and he was in the hospital for multiple weeks. Finally, as he was feeling better, he had a friend who was an attorney, and he calls the friend and says, "Would you come down to the hospital? I've got a big favor I need to ask of you." So his friends come down, and his friend comes down and he sits by the hospital bed and he explains this whole thing the way I've just explained it. And the friend says, "Well, why are you telling me this?" And he says, "I want to meet that lady. And I want you to find her for me." And the lawyer says, "Well, there were hundreds of cars backed up. Nobody took roll. What am I supposed to do? How do I... People were coming from hundreds of miles to see the game. I have... Where do I begin?" The man said, "Well, you have a piece of paper?" And he wrote down your license plate number. Now, what would my professor say to that? I don't know. But then the story didn't really describe the meeting with the woman, other than just saying the lawyer was able to find her quite quickly and went to the Department of Motor Vehicles and looked up the vehicle and found her, and the two, I suppose, they embraced, and he thanked her for saving his life. That's why we all come to meetings like this. Stories like that really, really touch our hearts. Well, I'd like to close with something that I found quite significant and probably the most important aspect of all the interviews conducted, people I've talked to. Once in a while, not very often, I would find someone who arrived at the reception area, either out in the park or in the beautiful room, and they weren't immediately sent back. They say, "Well, it really wasn't the theater where they took me, but that's probably the best word I can think of to describe it." One of them said, "Yeah, there was one of those angels sitting on each side of me. Went to this place. It was kind of like a movie, but a lot more than that. And I could see my life passing before us. And the reason it was so much more than a movie, I didn't just see the stuff I remembered. I saw and Betty Eady touches on this, I saw the rippling effect of many of the things I had done in life. If I had, maybe I said something good to a friend, a happy marriage or something, and the friend later on decided not to divorce his wife and leave his children, but I didn't know all that. Or maybe I said something mean to somebody at work and told them how stupid they were, and so they had a couple extra beers driving home that night and got in a car wreck or ran over a child going past this. I mean, just things like this. See that rippling effect of how your life made a difference for good and for bad. And this is always a very sobering time for the subject, and maybe that's why they have a nice angel sitting on each side of them so they don't try and die again. So I love those interviews. And those you don't find very often. But the conclusion of all of it, people ask me, "Well, Lee, why do you keep doing this? What?" And I haven't done one for a lot of years, but what's the lesson? What's the value? And I say, "Well, a lot of things happen, but I think of two things that seem to be common in nearly all the experiences, all the people I've talked to. And one of them is the subject generally loses their fear of death. Like the Carl Short, the first story I told you, he said, after that, and all that, even yelling at the angels, and but seeing what was going on, and that final confidence, that knowing that there's a life after death, and that it's a good place, and that I'll fit right in when I go there, he says, I had to be careful, because I wasn't afraid to die ever again. And I'd be out working on equipment, and doing different things that would be dangerous, and it just never occurred to me that dying would be something to be afraid of or to even worry about. You know, I just want to stay and raise my boys, but the fear of death seems to go away. And I've had so many people tell me that. And I don't know how important that is. I think to a lot of us, we might be too afraid and are even terrified of the thought of dying. And that is totally not necessary. The other thing that happens that I think is much more important and very profound, and I'm not sure how it happens, but as I talk to people at length after they've come back, the thing that seems to change, instead of watching the Jazz game tonight, maybe they'll go down to the rest home and visit an aging relative. Instead of going skiing Saturday, they might be more inclined to go over and help their neighbor, nail shingles on the roof that was leaking. This idea of, you know, how much money I'm at. I've never heard anybody say, yeah, I went in the room and everybody stopped talking because the state president had arrived. Or the president of some car dealership, or the professor with tenure from Utah State. I mean, those things are never even mentioned, and they're not important. And somehow that message comes through. Yeah, it doesn't matter how much I made, or how important I was, or how much authority and power I had as majority leader in the state house. Those things are becoming significant. And the question is, have I had a life where I've tried to lighten the burdens of others? And as people come back, those are the things that suddenly are more important in their lives than the things they think about. I mean, isn't that significant? And doesn't that make what you're all studying and learning about really important? And it's not trivial at all. And it's just neat to be in a time where these kinds of experiences are accepted and believed, and where people will open their hearts and be touched by things like what I've read to you tonight and told you tonight. There was a time when we would close the curtains and hope the janitors wouldn't call the police when they heard what we were talking about. It's not that way anymore. And I think that's cool. Those are my thoughts tonight. Thank you for inviting me. That you would make a good book.
Very good.